Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Well, 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 Friday has arrived. WTIC, thanks so much for being here. Todd with you. Michael Harrison still trying to connect, I believe, in the virtual world, the wonderful virtual world of virtual radio, where we can plug in a little box and digitize our voices and vault our voices across the universe. It's Friday, yes, but it's not just any Friday. It's the Friday before Tuesday. Polls are tightening in some cases. In some cases, they're loosening. And the race remains one that's causing great trepidation, one that's causing great anxiety. It's a race that's it feels like the rhetoric is accurate, that it's some unbelievable moment. What is that moment? What is going to happen? Where are we going to go? Michael Harrison joins us now so we can discuss these big topics. Hello there, Michael.
Hey there, Todd. How are you?
I'm rocking. I'm ready.
Yeah, I just slid in here. I just slid into home. And crazy day, crazy week. The last Friday before the election, we're going to be in a different world next week. You think?
Are we, or will it? I don't know. My rule of thumb is that whatever we believe as kind of a mainstream belief is not the thing that's actually operative.
How do you?
So everybody thinks it's going to be this messed up election, razor thin margins. It'll take days or weeks or years or a century to count all the ballots and figure it all out. And usually when everyone's geared for that, it goes a whole nother direction. Mm-hmm. It'll be easy. It'll be fast. We'll find out that Florida at 9 o'clock on Tuesday night has decided. And Florida, some people say that it's absolutely necessary. There's really no other viable path for Donald Trump to win this election than winning Florida, according to some prognosticators.
Some is the key word there. Some.
Yes, but nevertheless,
I've heard some say Pennsylvania, and then I hear others say Ohio.
Pennsylvania too, yeah.
You know, it's crazy. Everything in a close election, everything that happens was the reason it went that way. It's crazy. We tend to find patterns in things that suit our narrative, but the truth of the matter is, a whole bunch of other things have to happen for Florida, or Ohio, or Pennsylvania, or Wisconsin, to go the way they go and then be the deciding factor. It's all based upon a lot of other things happening. So you can't assume that's the case. I remember...
go ahead.
No, we're both talking because we have a little delay, so we'll be careful about that. You know, for the folks listening, if you wonder why we're talking over each other, it's because sometimes we don't have the best connection.
So, or sometimes we do have the best connection and we still talk over each other.
It's a different kind of talking over each other.
But now I forgot what I was going to say. So if you remember yours, go ahead.
Basically, I was going to say that in the Gore Bush election of 2000, which was sort of a precursor to what some people think might happen now, only this will be on steroids. That was a year during the campaign that we had our big radio convention, and we had some of the biggest movers and shakers in the industry at this convention in New York. And I invited Gore and I invited Bush to speak to the radio broadcasters, these talk show hosts at this convention. And that included a number of very heavy hitters from Florida. And back in 2000, talk radio, it still does today, but talk radio was even more influential in deciding an election back in 2000 than it is today, because there's so many other competing forms of media that voters look at or listen to. And Bush said he would come and Gore didn't. We had Bush there, and Bush got to address this giant packed crowd of radio talk show hosts and a ton from Florida. And then, of course, Florida came down to like something like 500 votes or whatever it was. And I went around saying, hey, I influenced this election because if it weren't for the fact that Bush spoke at our convention, he may not have won Florida.
And yeah, so that was in June, maybe, of 2000.
It was in June before it was. Bush was already the nominee, so it was post whenever the heck the
but before the convention.
I think it was post Republican convention. I believe they both were the candidates. And I remember
either way, though, it was an amazing thing because I was at that convention. This is a talk radio convention that Mike holds from Talkers Magazine.
Yeah, it was the Talkers Convention in New York across the street. We did it across the street from Lincoln Center. And
it was amazing. Bush was incredible. I spent maybe 5 minutes with Bush. Mm-hmm. He was posing for pictures.
He was fantastic.
Chit-chatting. He was amazing.
Right. He was fantastic. A lot of people think George W. Bush is not smart. A lot of it has to do with how you come across on television. Mm-hmm. And
did you get the feeling he was a smart guy?
I got the feeling he was a very wily, sharp guy. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. That's what I felt too. And his eyes had this gleam of intelligence in them, of understanding. It was so interesting to have that time with George W. Bush, and then to see how he was portrayed in the media. It's one of those events that built my mistrust of the mainstream media with how they how they'll take a narrative and assign it to somebody that's totally unfair. How does anybody know that he's too dumb to be president, which was a standard meme in the media back then?
Right. Well, sometimes television can make a person seem dumb. I'm blanking on, I always blank on the guy's name, Mr. Potato.
Jerry
the guy
Ford.
That was vice president with George W. Bush's father.
oh yes. Yes, okay. I'm looking at him. I can see him in my mind's eye. What was his name?
Why does his
the
name?
The guy who misspelled potato.
Right. This is, I
Dan
always,
Quayle.
I know I can Google in a second and find
Dan
him, but I always
Quayle.
Find this to be a great mental exercise.
Dan Quayle.
Yeah. There's something about a vice president's or a president's name starting with a Q that just, it doesn't register. Dan Quayle had a reputation for being a dummy. And that whole horrible potato incident, which he was a setup, there's a whole story behind that. Be that as it may, he had a reputation for not being smart. And when you saw him on television, he sort of came across as like a deer in headlights. And I had the opportunity to ask him some questions that were being covered by C-SPAN at a different event in Washington. And when I was at the event, one of the things that I was just amazed by was how smart this guy was, how present, how solid a man he was. And then I watched the same interaction between Dan Quayle and myself, and he appeared stupid on television. It was the same room, same person. And
do you think it was the Midwestern low-key demeanor?
I have no idea. No, this is an X factor that defies quantifying it or defining too heavily. They're just some things that are the way they are. It was a little more apparent back in Students of Presidential History. Looking back at the first major great debate for television between Senator John Fitzgerald Kennedy of Massachusetts and former Vice President Richard Milhouse Nixon, the people that heard the debate on the those debates were far more substantive. Those debates actually they each talked, nobody interrupted, and they laid out their plans, their policies, their positions. Very different than today, and they were very gentlemanly. The people that watched the debate on television, the polls indicated they thought that Kennedy won the debate. The people that listened to the debate on radio, the polls indicated people thought Nixon won the debate. That the appearance of the two of them swayed people to actually think that Kennedy had won the debate based on substance, because in those days, mm-hmm. they actually listened to the speeches of those days. They were far more substantial.
There was a forum. What was it? Bobby Kennedy went to Columbia to give a talk, or I think it was Bobby. It was so filled with honesty. Remarks you can't imagine somebody saying today who's running for president or on the national stage. It filled with substance and honesty and directness. And mm-hmm. it's so different from I don't think you can realize how superficial the coverage of presidential races and candidates is today unless you go back and look at one of those. And then it's a slap in the face. It's so direct. But Dan Quayle, I had a similar experience. I interviewed him. I don't know, maybe a decade after that, where he was maybe poking around running for president. And, you know, I had a half hour with him, and he was relaxed and nice and smart and about as reasonable a guy as you would want to see, but not with any kind of charisma. He had sort of an opposite dynamic going on, an uncharisma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So now, you know, we kind of veered away from, you know, what throws an election one way or the other. Is it Florida? Is it Ohio? Is it this or is it that? There's so much insubstantiability going on in terms of every aspect of this presidential election that even the pollsters don't know what they're doing. I've never seen such uncertainty in having a feel for the way something is going to go. You can't call it an upset.
Well, maybe that's based on fear of getting it wrong again, that they're being a lot more cautious. Michael Harrison is here. We'll take a quick break and continue the conversation. Yep, Tuesday is the election. We'll talk more coming up on WTIC. Yeah, we're talking to Michael Harrison. It's such an exciting moment in history. Great time to be involved with talk radio and having these conversations with you, Michael, and with this great WTIC audience. And we've been bouncing around memories of candidates and candidacies and other moments like this. What's the most profound experience you've had, Michael, with a big-time national politician or something similar? Do you have any good stories for us?
Well, my first major encounter with a national politician was at the age of approximately 14 or 15. Nelson Rockefeller was coming through my neighborhood on a Long Island Railroad train stop. And I waited for the train to come, and as soon as he stepped out, I ran up to him, put my arm around him, and had my friend take a picture. I said, "Governor, will you take a picture with me?" And that picture is up on the wall in my house to this day. It's a goofy-looking version of me. But my encounter with Bill Clinton was a life-changing experience. I mean, I spent time with Bill Clinton. He, for some reason, he just decided he was going to spend time with me. He wanted to learn about talk radio and talk media. And I was invited to the White House to interview him and basically, you know, had about 20 minutes with him. And then when it was over, he said to me, "You got time?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Hang with me for a while." I said, "What?" He said, "Hang with me."
How
I said, "Well, I got my bags and I got all my..." He says, "That'll be safe. Don't worry about it." And he, you know, and I hung with him for a few hours while he went about his rounds and things that he did. And that was the most surrealistic extraordinary political celebrity, you know, whatever you want to call
it. All in one.
All in one experience of my life. And it was really funny. It ended with Clinton and I walking from the old executive office building, which is where the bureaucracy of the administration is next to the White House. You know, all the offices that
right
make
next,
up.
Right on the property that you just right. walk across to it.
Right, right, the Eisenhower Building, they call it, I believe. And we were walking down the stairs. We after walking all over the executive office building where I met him, he said, "Let's go over to the White House out to the Oval Office," and we got to the door. Above this huge staircase that goes down to the parking lot. And as I walked around the grounds with him in the hallways and everything, everybody gave us space. It was almost as if he had this thing set up to really blow my mind. And as we got to the door and I'm looking down the stairs, I'm going to walk down these big concrete stairs to the parking lot with the President mm-hmm. of the United States and just totally in conversation with him. Down at the bottom of the parking lot were hundreds of television cameras and people with cameras, regular cameras. This was, you know, back in the 1990s. And what it was the daily White House photo opportunity. And I was the photo opportunity walking down the stairs with the president. And people are taking pictures of us and snapping pictures of us behind lines. And, you know, and I'm talking to him like we're having a conversation, trying, you know, I have enough media savvy not to go, "Oh, my God." And then we walked across from that area to the White House itself. Well, that was the same day. If you remember your history, that Fidel Castro dumped a bunch of his undesirables in a boat and sent them to the United States, and this Cuban boat with like criminals and all these people landed. It was a big story that day in terms of our relationship with Cuba and immigrants from Cuba. People used to swim across the thing and go on rafts to get out of Cuba, and all that. So Cuba was in the news that day. And that night on, I believe, the NBC Evening News, they had their photo opportunity. And they showed, and I had a big black mustache in those days. And I looked like, you know,
Zorro. You were the FM guy, huh?
Right. And I was wearing a suit. I looked pretty, well, compared to now, I looked pretty cool. And it said on this newscast that President Clinton today met with his Cuban advisor. And I was the Cuban advisor. And it was remarkable, Todd.
You just paddled in, huh?
I was the Cuban advisor, which just goes to show you what a reality show the White House has always been, with photo opportunities and setting things up and you know, everything planned. It's an amazing process. The president goes from one thing to another with handlers, and the press just wants something, anything. So because I had a big mustache, I looked like, you know, maybe I was in Ricky Ricardo's band or something. I was.
Did you get invitations direct from Fidel to come and visit and take gifts?
But here's the part that's really funny. Some of the people that I know in the media and friends who saw this. In those days, those evening newscasts were, everybody watched them. It wasn't as fractionalized. Some of them actually said, "You son of a gun, you're a Cuban advisor to the president and you never told us." Because if it was on television, it had to be true. I was out.
Yeah, it had to be true.
Right.
Yes. So it's like you were a CIA and hiding from them.
That was a pretty cool story. I was with Clinton.
Oh, my. Look, I knew you would have a story because I've never asked you a question like that before when you have not had the most outrageous of such stories. And to be able to walk around, to have that experience of walking with the President of the United States around the grounds of the White House and
right.
to go from the executive office building over to the Oval Office and to just be like you are hanging out with him. What an incredible experience.
But you know what I kept thinking throughout it? I kept thinking to myself, "Oh God, please have this end. I don't know what to say to him anymore. You talk about awkward, because it wasn't an official interview. It wasn't an official anything. And, you know, and the time was, and I felt like I was taking up the world's business. Like, why are you wasting your time with me? You know, and I also had this feeling that I was a ground zero of life.
Hang on, we'll talk more about this. We've got to get to a news update. Michael Harrison reminiscing about the day he hung around with Bill Clinton, which is almost as good as the days he hung around with George Harrison. More coming up after news on WTIC. Michael Harrison is here, publisher of Talkers Magazine, Talkers.com, the trade journal of the talk radio industry. And you can tell what that's done in terms of connecting him with people. Wow, what a story about Bill Clinton. He's also the host of the Michael Harrison Rap, which you can hear on WTIC Saturdays at 2 o'clock. So that's a pretty profound experience, getting to hang around at the White House with Bill Clinton. And he did have that kind of personality where he liked people, and he would spontaneously invite people to spend time with him beyond what they were scheduled to do when they had an official visit. It's an unusual thing.
Never expected that to happen. But the presidents that I've had encounters with in terms of that type of thing were George W. Bush, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and Donald Trump. But that experience with Clinton was off the charts, and it gave me a tremendous insight into what it's like to be president and to be at the White House and to be in that bubble where every time you walk into a room, you're announced. Can you imagine all day long, ladies and gentlemen, the president of the United States, every time you walk into a room?
Wait, even like, walking around the White House?
Yeah, if it's some kind of an official meeting or serious situation, what Clinton did with me was a lot of the people that work in the office building, the old executive office building as it was called then, are office workers. They don't get to see the president. They don't get to see any of that. It's officey. And he went, and I don't know if it's three floors, four floors, two floors, I don't recall, but he said, let's just walk and talk, you and I'll talk. And as we talk, he said, the people that work in all the offices off of this big hallway will be coming to the edge because the president is coming, and a lot of them have never seen me. And so as we went from door to door, he would leave me and go over to the door and shake hands and talk. It was as if they were fans. It was just amazing how it operates. Now, of course, I don't know if it operates that way under Trump. I would imagine every chief executive runs the ship differently. One of the things I always ask big-time politicians, governors, senators, presidents, and vice presidents, I always ask them the question, I don't know if anybody's ever asked you this before, but when you first got the job and you showed up at work, how'd you know what to do? How did you know what the president does in terms of the day-to-day operation of your office and the people that work for you? And, you know, and every one of them say, boy, that's a great question. It was daunting, you know. It really was like, oh, my gosh, what do I do? And there's always somebody at the White House or at the governor's mansion or in the Congress or the Senate that takes the person aside and says, okay, here's the way it goes. A person that's not impressed with them, been around forever, you know, part of the deep state. And here's the keys to the bathroom. And here's a button you press if you're hungry. And it's interesting.
It's up to you. If you're hungry, you press a button and somebody runs with the
When you're the president of the United States, your tuchus is kissed constantly. I mean, it is the most amazing thing how the air gets thick in every room that you are and people are aware of it. And that is a problem for presidents because they lose their immunity to being regular people. That's why presidents, incumbent presidents, don't often do well in the first debate. when they have a debate against a person.
They're used to being sweet-talked all the time.
Constantly. Constantly. Yes, yes, men or yes, women. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Anything you want,
Well, it
sir.
Would make you that idea makes you realize how important it would be to have some kind of inner circle of people where you require of them. I remember Rose Kennedy, her thing was when Jack, as soon as Jack was elected president, his mother would never call him by his name. She would just call him Mr. President. And I'm thinking, how do you live like that if nobody will talk to you like you're a human?
Well, isn't it interesting when you see the Trump family refer to him as the president as opposed to my dad or my, sometimes Melania says my husband, but for the most part, it's the president. And one of the things that Trump loves to do, and as a matter of fact, I've heard it said by body language and truth experts that it's a key to when he lies. When he tells a story and he does the dialogue of him talking to somebody, he always says, and they said to me, well, sir, blah, 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 blah. And sir, whenever he uses the word sir to describe how people talk to him, there's a good chance he's fibbing.
That's a tell, huh?
That's a tell. That's a tell. I don't know if it's true or not, but I've heard it said by a number of people who make a specialty of that. Yeah,
I love it. That's great. Sir is the self-aggrandizement. Is that the idea?
Well, yeah, you know, sir. I mean, I don't. Yeah, he likes. Trump likes being president.
Oh, he loves it.
Yeah, he even likes the hardship.
Yes, the whole thing. He was designed for it.
Yeah,
you know, he's somebody who always thought that he is the most important person on the planet. I think, and the smartest guy, and he revels in that. He's got a performer's personality, wants to be the center of attention. It's a fascinating thing that there is such a thing, because for me, I'm a shy person. I want to go hide in the corner when there's a bright light. Huh. And other people respond in a 180 from that. They just go running. They see the light go on, and they assume it's for them.
Yeah. Well, I think that Trump is the second greatest reality show president we've ever had.
And who's the first?
Who do you think was the first?
The greatest reality show president?
Yeah, the greatest person who played the part of president so well that he actually became a great president.
Well, I guess you were talking about Ronald Reagan.
Absolutely.
That's the only thing. Yeah. I mean, he was a wonderful performer, but I one of the things I think was great about Reagan was the naturalness with which he slipped into that role. He understood it inside out, and he was well prepared for it, too. That's my only problem with that is that he was so much an ideological person who really wanted to fix America and bring it back in line with what his vision was. So I think of him as a natural performer, not somebody who had to work at it.
Hmm. Yeah, he did a great job of playing the part of president. And as a result, maybe if you act like something, you become that. You know, this is all interesting stuff about reality, you know.
Yeah, I do that every day, pretending to be a talk radio host.
There's more truth to that than you realize, and I don't mean it about you specifically. One of the keys to generating confidence among an audience, a votership, a customer base, is to believe yourself that you belong there. Mm-hmm. If you are not tentative in what you do, but you act like you belong there, I belong here, people will invariably believe you belong there and give you the authority.
Well, you're right about it being a self-fulfilling prophecy, too. You know those, there was a famous scammer years ago who pretended to be, he would spontaneously make himself into being a doctor, and he would throw on a white gown and walk in and start doing surgery.
Great imposter.
And it takes an incredible amount of confidence, an ability to slip yourself into the position of confidence first, so that you don't get so flustered you can't bring your full self to the challenge of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just being a doctor or being a president. It could be being a waiter or a waitress in a restaurant or being somebody who's driving an Uber. Or if you are tentative in what you do, it's like playing the piano and looking at your fingers, or playing a guitar and looking at your hands, or dancing and looking at your feet. a real pro doesn't look at their feet. They don't look at their hands. A waiter puts the glass down with confidence and gets out of the way. Doesn't look like he may spill it on you. All of these little things begin with self-belief. I belong here. I am a professional waiter. I am not some guy who's just got a job as a waiter and, oh my God, I hope that the people don't know that I have no confidence, because immediately they'll know that.
So can you think of a president who failed on that test?
No, not off the top of my head.
Maybe Jimmy Carter.
Jimmy Carter, he failed on a number of levels, but I don't know if he failed in terms of being confident.
Well, there wasn't that feeling of, he didn't have that presence like some other people did. There was a solidity to the, say, an LBJ. Lyndon Johnson didn't have any doubts about himself terms of his performance.
Yeah, you make a good point. Of all the presidents that run through my head, I would say Jimmy Carter probably was the guy that generated the least amount of confidence in those of us who look to him as the president. Yeah.
That glow of gravitas and charisma that comes because I think the charisma comes from the confidence that you're talking about.
Confidence. There's
something about somebody believing in themselves that deeply that gives them a magnetic charm and appeal.
Right. Right. And that confidence supersedes performance. It takes on a life of its own. It's interesting. It's fascinating, because underneath it all, we're all just a bunch of human beings. We're all the same in that regard. Mm-hmm. And some of us wake up one morning and we're running the free world, you know?
Yeah, it is an amazing thing. But that comes from working your way up to it. So before Bill Clinton was running the free world, he was running the free Arkansas. And he had the chance to practice on a smaller stage. And before you're a singer at the Grammy Awards or, you know, performing on some big stage,
right,
you're a singer at a lot of local little auditoriums with 30 people in them. And you get the thing down. But some people never get confident doing that, and other people do it right off the bat. They exude confidence. It's fascinating.
It is. So back to Florida. Anybody who says it's going to come down to Florida or it's going to come down to Ohio, they don't know what they're talking about, because a lot of other things have to happen. What if he only wins Florida? If you just found out now, well, he's going to win Florida. Let's bet on Trump. He's going to win, or the other way around with Biden. It doesn't mean anything. It's in a vacuum.
Well, I don't know if that's true. I think you're taking it a little too far. There's people sitting there all day, every day, looking at the latest polls and figuring out what the most likely flow of states is that can cause Biden or Trump to become president. And several of them are saying Trump really doesn't have a path without Florida. Now, they don't mean that it's impossible. Like, if Trump won California, of course he wouldn't need Florida.
But he's not going to win California. But you don't know that he's not going to win California. Either the pollsters are right or they're wrong. The thing that makes most pollsters is they believe their pollsters. They have confidence because they're just gypsy fortune tellers. They're just making it up. Don't say that. Why not?
They're using scientific methodology that they've been using for years, so they can repeat their results, and they have some sense of mastery. It's not that they don't make mistakes, but they're not walking onto the field for the first time with no background.
I ultimately believe, and this is just my own idiosyncrasy, I ultimately believe that all science in terms of research, I'm not talking about, you know, chemistry, all of the scientific things about human nature, sociology,
start
with somebody's gut feeling, and then they go about creating statistics that back it up.
Yeah, well, that's a form of science. I think if you can repeat the things enough time, the events enough times, then there's something to it. But you're right, it's not etched in stone the way chemical reactions are. Michael Harrison is here, and we're doing our Friday chat. Stay with us. More coming up on WTIC. So does your last statement, Michael Harrison, mean that you're a scientist, that you've got a knack for the physical sciences?
I mean, I respect the physical sciences because it's a mode of thought to find the truth, but I don't believe something is necessarily true because it was arrived at through the scientific method. You know, when I went to school, they taught you the scientific method, you know, a hypothesis and, you know, all of that, a theory. So I think that there's a lot of art to science, and some science is more scientific than others. But every time you go to a doctor and then you get a second opinion, there you go. And you're just because somebody says something doesn't mean it's the answer.
That's true. Yeah. Well, so, you've got that human there between the science and the diagnosis as well. No, but I had a very practical, silly reason for asking you that, because I think about the physical sciences, which I never really studied much and never had a knack for and never understood. But I have this, I do radio standing up. I like to pace. And I have this little area rug that's like 4 feet across and 3 feet wide that I stand on for extra comfort. And it's inexplicable to me that it always moves in one direction over the course of the show, and I have to keep readjusting it, but it keeps moving across the room in the same direction. Exactly, there you go. And I can't think of a reason in the world what it is that's happening physically that could make the rug know it wants to go in the same direction every step I take.
The same thing that makes a Ouija board work. Or the same thing that makes, you know, those little games we play with the string,
with the
weight at the... It has to do with subliminal vibrations that you don't realize you're putting out. This is a scientific explanation. It's not metaphysical.
Okay.
Your body sends out a certain kind of vibration in terms of the axes of direction within the room, and it comes out through the carpet. And you're not even thinking about it, but it has to do with the way you're wired.
I guess. Maybe if I do a 180, and instead of facing all my studio equipment, I just face the other wall and pace this way. Maybe it'll change.
Try that.
You've given me an idea.
Try that
and
see if the carpet moves. It's possible.
Well, it's always moving. It's always moving. That's what's so weird. It just always goes in the same direction. It clearly wants out because it keeps moving towards the door.
maybe it wants to be one of those flying carpets from days of old.
All right, we've got a minute left. What are you doing on the weekend? Are you doing anything fun?
I'm going to go trick-or-treating.
No. Are you? I thought that was illegal now.
It is. I'll watch the Pats. I will catch up on my writing and rest a little bit. You know, I've been traveling from, you know, we came back from Florida and the house is a mess and all kinds of things. So, you know, there's plenty to do. I don't have any special plans. I'm going to do a little bit of the Halloween thing with my 3-year-old grandson.
Ooh, that's great.
And that's it. I'm going to dress up as a mask.
So you don't mind watching the Patriots now that they can't win a game?
I'm going to give them one more game.
One more.
And then I'm going to turn on.
And then switch over to the Bucs?
I'm still jilted and angry at Brady. It's going to take me about a year or two.
Oh, you are a difficult creature.
It's hard being me.
Yeah. All right, Michael. Well, thanks for
the minute over,
stories.
Or do I have to come up with something else clever?
No, you're done. You're free. You can relax for the weekend and commiserate with me after the Patriots turn in another miserable performance. Thank you, Michael Harrison. We'll be listening to you at 2 o'clock tomorrow on WTIC.
Thank you, Todd.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.